Welcome.
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 You're listening to
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
On today's episode of Built by Us, we are joined by Carrie Points, a white dyke who grew up in working class and rural southern Indiana as a ward of the state and adoptee. She is an anti-racist facilitator and political educator based in Durham, North Carolina. For 30 years, Carrie has organized and advocated globally and domestically for collective liberation grounded in mutual interest. So we are speaking with Carrie today to talk about how white folks can and should be working towards dismantling white supremacy for our collective liberation. We are very excited to be joined by Carrie Points, who is a white anti-racist facilitator based in Durham. Thank you so much for being with us, Carrie.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Taylor.
So, Carrie, we know you have been organizing and advocating for 30 years as an anti-racist facilitator and political educator. We believe that is so amazing, and we're so glad that you landed here in Durham from Indiana. So will you tell us a little bit more about your journey and what brought you to this work?
Absolutely. I was thinking about what was the first action I ever took. And I think it was when I was about 8 years old, and I wrote a letter to the editor for library access for rural people, because my family lived out in the country in southern Indiana, and we weren't allowed to check books out of the library for tax reasons. Now I think I probably understand. And I wrote a letter advocating for rural families to be able to check books out of the library, because I wanted to check books out of the library. And you know, their response was to let my family do it. And I didn't understand at the time how to respond to that sort of, duck and weave on their part. But then I think later on, I started to understand that more as a teenager. There were four of us who made a collective decision in my church not to join the church, which was not a popular decision with our parents or the pastor. And I learned then about the power of collective action. Even four people standing together meant that none of us caved. And I started to get the sense of why that was important and how that could be a strategy. And then I'll also just share that as a young adult, I have a background as a ward of the state, and I was eventually adopted in a closed adoption. It meant that I didn't have access to any information about where I came from. And that was a lot of the early work that I did was around the politics and the history of people who are in foster care, who are wards of the state, who are in closed adoptions. So those were some of the foundations of my political work as a very young person.
Your first action was a letter to the editor at 8 years old. It is so young to do something that is such a formal organizing strategy and tactic.
I never do that today. I don't ever write letters to the editor, but I did as a kid.
I think that is really wonderful that that's the first action you took, because that is so funny. And I also think that it's interesting that you were able to learn such a specific lesson as well, that larger issue of the entirety of rural areas not having access to something like your public library.
It was a good lesson.
For sure. So how do you think that those experiences have led you to find your niche in the movement, being a facilitator and an educator?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think of myself as having a niche in the movement, but I do see myself as working in a web of people who are bringing creativity and tenacity and generativity and lots of work around trauma and healing. And people who have a sense of humor as well as a sense of radical possibility, right? I think you have to have a pretty wicked sense of humor at some point to do this work. And my role is really just to be a part of this web and to offer up what I can. So, I mean, I think I have particular strengths around a class analysis as somebody who was born poor and grew up working class and was kind of in the system of the state as a baby. And I always bring a feminist and dyke lens to it. You know, that's a big part of kind of how I see the world. And somatics work, which comes out of healing and trauma for me. And I think that, so maybe some combination of those things. And I, you know, I can bring organizational development skills. I think that's part of what I bring is movement and organizational transformation. I think I support that as best I can, both in my individual work and in my work with organizations.
Okay. So speaking of your work, you currently co-lead the organizing project We Are Finding Freedom, which is a training organization that's made up of, quote, white women taking on their own white supremacy. So, you know, how would you describe your work and kind of the goals of this project?
Yeah, We Are Finding Freedom is a project that I started in 2017 with Evangeline Weiss, who's also based here in North Carolina in Greensboro. And really, we saw this as a response to the election. And we were trying to figure out, there was a lot of conversation at that point about what white women's role exactly was in electing Trump. And we knew that they played a big role, that white women played a big role in it. And I think that we didn't know what to do, but it felt like we should do something. And so we kind of got to the point where we said, okay, we don't know what the right thing is. And we know that the right thing is not sitting here and talking about it for another year. Like, we just decided to try something and see what happened. And a lot of our work has been organized around this idea from Linda Burnham, who's a Black feminist movement strategist. And she says, if we don't organize white people around their suffering, we know someone else will. So that has propelled us into action, along with Finding Freedom, which is a part of a quote from Ann Braden, who is a white Southern anti-racist activist born in Alabama, I believe, and who did a lot of work with her husband around inequality and segregation in the housing market in Louisville, Kentucky. So for us, Finding Freedom felt like a place where we know that white people are culturally organizing with other white people, but we never call it that, right? So on the right, that might look like purity balls or January 6th, but on the left, it also looks like food co-ops and community choirs and churches and farmers markets, which we never really think of as white cultural organizing in the same way that we might on the right. And those spaces almost never actually name that whiteness is a part of what they're doing. And we know that a sense of belonging is a basic human need. Right? People are going to gravitate towards places and communities where they feel a sense of belonging, almost regardless of sometimes of what the political background is, because we need that as humans. And I think that if we do that without being clear that we're reproducing whiteness and white supremacy, and whiteness by definition is oblivious to itself, right? Once you start seeing it, then that's the first step to start undoing it, I think. And if you're not clear that you're replicating or reproducing whiteness, then nothing's going to change. So what Finding Freedom has evolved into is, I think, I hope, is a place for people to experience belonging in space with other white people that's intentionally anti-racist, it's intentionally feminist, there's a class analysis. And it's also a place to do really deep work emotionally, spiritually, relationally, right? Which is, I think, where all this work happens. Like I often say, like, all this work happens in the parts of our bodies that you can't see on Zoom. And I think for some people, Finding Freedom has started to become a movement home. I think maybe about 700 people have gone through it to date. And for some people, it has been a place that they return to over and over again, and they engage at higher and higher levels. And I really think having a movement home doesn't have to be Finding Freedom, but having a place where you have a sense of belonging and it's intentional about what you're doing, that's key for any white person who's looking to do work in their own white or white dominant communities, which is exactly where Black leaders have been asking white people to work for literally like 60 or 70 years at this point.
I think that that whole description that you just gave of this project, it feels enlightening in a way of one of the goals that you have is to just name what's going on, and like your ability to explain that white organizing already happens. We don't call it that. So let's make a space that is white organizing in like the positive ways, like the ways that we could be doing something more with it
to get to our linked liberation, because we talk about that a lot on this podcast and how it's, you know, it's not white people working for a future that's better for people of color. It is that it's better for all of us. So I really appreciate just how clear that is in the project, because it's so easy for this work to get overwhelming and to, I mean, honestly, just get confused about what it is that you're going for, like what your goals are. So I think that the clarity would be hopefully something that our listeners can hear, and hopefully our white women can hear and be excited about possibly going to look up We Are Finding Freedom and joining a session or the next cohort of training that you'll be doing. And so you brought up a couple times somatics. And so I, as someone who only learned what somatics was through you, would love to hear a quick description about what somatics is and why you have found it so important in this work, in connecting it with this work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the process of having trauma and then working on healing with that trauma produces, in my experience, truth tellers, right? It's like you have this like life experience, or at least this is true for me. Like I feel kind of like my role is to speak some truth out into white communities, especially white queer communities, communities of white women. And naming what's happening inside of our bodies is just observing, gaining the ability to observe what's happening inside of our bodies allows us to like slow down all of the stuff, right? So we've pushed so many things down inside of ourselves as white people in order to remain white, right? So that includes trauma, it includes harm we've done, it includes fear, but it also includes joy and our desire to connect with other people, right? And I think that somatics is a way to remind ourselves about what we need as humans and find a way to create that in communities where we have basically walled ourselves off from each other in order to benefit from white supremacy. So for me, it's like, and I know that there's a brand of somatics out there that I have learned a lot from, but the style that I like to bring to my work is more kind of like a Southern fried somatics, you might call it, where it's like, and this is really hard on Zoom, but it's like, you need to feed people. Hello. You need to feed people. And it's not like an apple and some unsalted almonds, right? You need to feed people. You need to have music. You need to like have maybe some singing. You need to like let people connect with each other and have unstructured time. You know, you need to let people like just tell jokes and make fun of things. And I think that petty makes room for kind. That's just like a personal philosophy of mine. People need room to like off gas about all the stuff that we're constantly have coming at us. And I think that the South brings this thing that I don't see in organizing in any other part of the country. And I'm often working with organizations on the West Coast or in the Northeast. And they're like, we want to be less transactional. And I'm like, then you need to move to the South. I don't know what to tell you. Because it's not that that can't happen here. It does. But I think we are farther along than most parts of the country in understanding what it means to connect with each other relationally, right? And to me, somatics is not just what's happening in my individual body sitting here in Durham, right? It's also about who stood behind me and who is still standing behind me as I think about what I'm doing. It's about who I can reach out to on either side of me, right? It's about the earth below my feet and the sun above my head. And that, all of that informs what I can do in front of me, like where, how and where I go forward.
And imagery is so strong because I've found, since I've learned about somatics through you, I found that I it's just been very clear how disconnected I personally am from my body. And so every time you ask us to stop and think, what is it that we're feeling? What are each parts of our body doing? And in addition to what you just spoke about, who is behind us, you've had us talk a lot about, you know, our white anti-racist role models, like our ancestors that we could follow in the footsteps of. And so all of that imagery is very strong, in addition to the fact that I never want to eat an unsalted almond. Like, I just don't. So I appreciate you bringing that up, because like nuts must be salted. And I just
thank you.
Feel very strongly about that.
Key to movement progressing.
I feel like that's an important thing to know.
I'm kind of curious, with all of these teachings, like, is there any lessons that like you've learned through facilitating these different meetings and introducing people to somatics and all of these things?
Oh, so much. One thing I have learned is that people, all people, this isn't even just white people, are not going to get it when you're trying to do something that's not really being done. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, emergent work is hard. You're not going to get a lot of praise for emergent work. You have to be willing to do it because it's something that you hope is in the right direction. Because in the beginning, when we started doing this, a lot of people had a problem with it. And that was only 5 years ago. But a lot of people pushed back on it pretty hard. And I think for us, there was that generated a lot of doubt in us. Are we doing the wrong thing? And even, are we like putting participants at risk? Because I did a workshop in Wilmington where there was I went on television, which is the only time I've ever done that in my life, to talk on like the local news station about what we were going to be doing. And like 400, 300 racist, I think it was like armchair racists, and they weren't all in North Carolina, came out of the woodwork. And I had to like get security. I got like community security for the event, no cops. And because I was afraid. But then one of my movement mentors said to me that if they're coming for you like that, then you're doing the right thing. And that helped me ground me and be like, okay, I don't have to be afraid. Our community can have a plan for this. And also like people of color also are like, what are you doing? We don't understand. It's creepy. And it's never really worked out well for us for a bunch of white people to be alone in a room together talking about race. So ew. And, you know, and that was like an understandable response. And I think it was one that helped hold us accountable for what we were doing in the room. And, you know, an interesting thing started to happen. Like, we started to have mixed race people approach us and say, can we participate? Which I never imagined that they would want to do. But people were like, I want to explore the white side of my family, or I'm white presenting, but when I open my mouth, I have an accent. And so I get perceived in these different ways, depending on whether I'm talking or not, you know? And so it started to deepen our work as people started to approach us to say, what would it be like for me to participate in this? And I think that was a real learning for me, right? Is both like, have the nerve to do what you're going to do. And you don't have to have all the answers up front, but you do need to engage people around the questions that they have, especially people of color. And that you will be creating something as you go. Like, that's the only way to do emergent work, is that you create it as you go. And so those are some of the things I learned. I also learned, like, you know, I already said this really, but like a sense of humor goes a long way. Everybody comes in very dour, you know, with their shoulders up to their ears and not making eye contact. And like, is somebody going to make me publicly shame myself? And, you know, we do a lot of things like bring down the shoulders and get people connecting with each other and realizing like, that's not what this space is at all. You may have shame about it, and we'll get to that, but like, this is not a space for shaming you. No, nothing good ever came out of shaming, except maybe if you're punching it up. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that you talking about shame is, I remember it being central to a lot of your trainings, and something that as white people to like recognize and then move beyond because of this. You know, I think that many of us or many of our listeners have heard the phrase white guilt and understand that doing work out of white guilt is not the, you know, not actually the most productive way to do it. So Could you share a little bit about your philosophy on shame and how we work through it?
I think white guilt is basically a charity model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's like, I'm going to be able to remain here in my position as I am. I'm not going to have to be vulnerable in any way. And I can bestow freedom on people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the foundation of, you know, if all you're really operating from is white guilt, is that you can kind of relieve yourself of a bad feeling by, I don't know, not calling the police. I don't know.
Right.
But for me, that is a way that actually just kind of reinforces our position in white supremacy. And my goal is to get us free of white supremacy alongside people of color. Right. So shame and guilt are very connected emotions. They're not quite the same. I think guilt is like guilt about something you've done, and shame is more about who you are, shame about who you are. But I still think that both of those are like, shame is paralyzing. You know, once you're in shame, it's like you can't even look somebody in the eye. You know, you don't reach out to other people, you get tunnel vision. And I think that shame just freezes us. I think whiteness freezes us, and I think shame keeps us in that frozen state. And it produces, you know, I think it's part of like the fight, flight, freeze, fawn syndrome that I associate, like that's used as a trauma model, but I also see it in the way that we as white people tend to show up as we react in one of those four ways. And I think releasing that shame or recognizing the role that that shame is serving frees us up to actually say, what's my investment in this? Why do I, you're telling me that I'm trapped in white supremacy? It's not somebody else that needs me to come and like get them out of the amber, you know? It's like, no, it's you. Like, we're the ones trapped in it, right? And that, I think, for a lot of people is a real plot twist when they are in our workshops, to realize that that our liberation is at stake, right? And that all of the things that we tend to look towards communities of color, especially on the left, but not exclusively, and like yearn for, like, I want that level of connection. I want that level of like cultural engagement. I want that music. I want that clothing. I want that hair, blah, 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 right? That to me is like a product of not realizing that we're the ones caught in the amber. Right. And loosening ourselves from all of that is part of what allows us to reconnect to the places we come from. I'm going to be doing a workshop on anti-racist genealogy later in the spring. That's about like, how do we reclaim our ancestors who, Lord knows, we're not perfect, but nobody's ancestors were perfect. Right. How do we go back and do some like forensics? Because we also then want to be different kinds of ancestors than what we were trained to be. I want to be a better ancestor than the elders who came before me. And also, I don't want to just kick them to the curb. They're my people.
A lot of points you mentioned in there, we talk a lot about on the podcast all the time. And specifically thinking about how our liberation is linked and like how we are working towards that future personally. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what do you think that future that you have imagined for us is? It's such a big question. And so we love to ask all of our guests because the answers are always so different. And so I'd just love to get your perspective on it as well.
Oh, I love this question so much. And it is huge.
It is. But we have to think about it too. It's so important in the journey, I feel like.
I went to a workshop one time as a participant where we played a game where about freedom. And certain people, like, I don't quite know the rules, but basically some people, it was whispered to them that they were already free. And some people, it was whispered to them that once they got free, they could free other people. And some people got free at a certain point, like got released into freedom. And other people could be tapped to be freed by somebody else, but didn't know that. And it was, I think the most amazing thing to me was to realize that once I got free, I didn't know what to do. And it didn't even occur to me to just do it, like to just go free people, because I was free. Like I was no longer had to follow the rules of the game. I could just be like, okay, let's just free each other, right? And that was so profound for me to realize, like, what am I even imagining we're working toward here, that we're playing toward? And I don't know that I have an answer for that yet, but what has evolved for me since then is that there's no like individual path to freedom, right? And collective work is hard. It's often fraught with all of the things that we come into it with. It's fraught with bad communication sometimes, and struggles to name what's bothering us. But I think that the future is not something that I alone can imagine. It's something that we dream ourselves and each other into collectively, consciously. And I really want white people not to shy away from our part, right? There's often this kind of like, well, you know, who am I to say what the future looks like for all of us? And I'm like, because you're a human in it. And if you don't do it, then what are we left with? A bunch of white people who didn't participate in dreaming ourselves into the future and who are resentful that they're not participating in it, which is literally where we are right now. And so I really think that's why for me it has been most important to just say, try something, do it collectively, do it with one or two other people, start somewhere, and always follow the thing that feels like it satisfies a yearning inside of you for freedom. That's the best I can say.
I love you bringing up that it's everyone's responsibility to dream up the new future, because, you know, if we're all going to work towards it, we should all be thinking about it. And it doesn't mean that, like, there's not one right way. So there's not going to be one correct future. And just because we haven't thought about it enough yet doesn't mean that we couldn't come up with something amazing. And if we're not thinking about what we're working toward, then how do we know what we're working toward? So just exactly what you said. And I think that that's such a great lesson to everybody, including me, to remind myself that I shouldn't just be listening to other people who I believe are smarter than me, because yes, I should be doing that, but also we should all be dreaming. We should all be trying to be visionaries. So I just appreciate that special note there.
Yeah. What I see, especially for white people who have a lot of formal education, is that we imagine that the way we're going to get there is through spreadsheets or something. I don't know. Like, we're going to get there through analysis, and that has analysis is really important. And I think that's just a prerequisite to doing the work, right? So trying, experimenting is what the work is. Learning from what failed and what didn't is what the work is. Turning around, trying something again very soon after that is what the work is.
I love to emphasize this point anytime we have this conversation, but you know, the best part about this question is like you said, we don't know. We don't know what the future is going to look like. We don't know how to get there. And so it's really this question of reimagining the future, because that's what you have to do. You have to put yourself in that mindset. The future is going to be something we haven't seen before, and we don't know how to make it, but we have to try all these different ways to get there. And I just love having this conversation. Asking this question has just reminded me of the importance so much more of really just asking yourself that question. It seems like it doesn't do anything, like you're not making steps, but you are taking steps by reimagining what the future could look like and what your role could be in getting to that future. And so, yeah, I just always love this question. I love hearing everybody's thoughts from it. And I totally agree. We have to try. The work is about trying, practicing, experimenting. Yeah, I love that.
I remembered what I was going to say, which is you helped me by what you said. So we're doing a 2.0 in Finding Freedom right now that's called the Yes Lab. And it focuses on abolition, economic justice, and reproductive justice. What do these frames mean for us as white people? Can we use them? Should we use them? How do we use them? And then what, and then cultural organizing as a strategy, because, you know, there's, I don't know, even know, it's probably at this point, 50 years at least of Afrofuturism, right? In like everything from highbrow to like totally pop culture. And especially in the last 20 years, I would say. And often we've asked like people in class, like, what's our version of Afrofuturism? Do we have a version of the future? Or are we always going to be looking backwards? And one of the things that came up when we most recently talked about it was that at the beginning of the pandemic, I was immediately like put on some WhatsApp thread for like very local mutual aid in my neighborhood, or like in these neighborhoods right here in Durham. And instantly there were like 47 spreadsheets that all led to other spreadsheets. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. It was so many spreadsheets, and it was just endless lists of all these things and people and whatever. And I remember we all got on a call at one point. It was like 10 people, and everybody was saying, this is what I can do. This is what I can do. And I said, you know, great. I wonder if we could spend some time hearing what people need. Like, what is it that you would like to receive in aid from this group? And people looked at me like I have four heads. And I was like, oh, that's because this is a charity model. They don't want to need anything from this group. They don't want to need, it's actually not mutual aid, it's charity. So for me, that was like an old model pretending to be a new model. Like, you could call it mutual aid and put it on a WhatsApp thread, it's still charity, right? And when somebody later on, like, I had already exited the thread, but a friend told me this, somebody said, hey, can somebody go get some groceries for this elderly man in my neighborhood? It was like crickets. But, you know, in some ways, that's abolition. At a very beginning level, that's abolition, right? Is that you're not looking to these huge systems, which we already know don't serve our needs, right? It's literally right. Just like picking up some groceries for somebody. That was a lesson for me about what it means to imagine the future.
I don't know if you scrolled back in our archives, Carrie, but we had a really amazing episode last summer about mutual aid. And I didn't know very much about mutual aid, because for me, the first time I saw it is when it started popping up in 2020 because of the pandemic. And I didn't really understand what it was. So I was excited to have that conversation. And when that particular point was made, it blew my mind. The necessity for it to be give and take, like, that is what makes it mutual, is that, and the fact that I should be thinking about the things that I need as well as what I can give to my community. And so I just appreciate hearing that point again, because I think it bears repeating. Something else that we like to hear from all of our interviewees, what is the strategy that you use to bring people along in this work?
Honestly, I think for me, at the level of just me as an individual doing this work, it's that I spend a lot of time just validating people's experiences and letting them know when they're onto something. And I think that that's kind of an important role for people. I mean, I'm 53, and I think at a certain point, I don't think I'm a movement elder, but hopefully I will be one day. I think that it's like, I love doing coaching and mentoring and support and that kind of like strategizing about how are you going to go into this, you know, meeting and bring this stuff up that never has been talked about before? Or how are you going to go into your kid's school and talk about what they're reading or whatever? And I like being that like strategic thought partner for people. And I think that we need to do that for each other. I did not have a lot of mentors in this work when I was young, and I wish I did. I wish I had somebody or people to guide me. And so I guess it's an intergenerational theory of change in some ways. You know, it's like, and if we don't operate as like young people have all the answers or old people have all the answers, right? But to say like movement, what I see happening in movements today, as opposed to like 30 years ago, it's the same questions. It's the same heartbreaks. It's the same struggles. And so I would like to participate in the sense that I think that learning and sharing and supporting each other is a part of breaking down some of the patterns of white supremacy, but also it's like what allows people to feel like they have the courage and the backbench to take risks. That's, I don't know if that's a theory of change, but it's something about where I sit within the movement, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think that's important too. And, you know, I'm also really curious, you know, what's your favorite part about where you sit in the movement? What's your favorite part of your work that you do in general?
I was thinking about Chloe Kim. I love Chloe Kim.
Me too. Me too. How can we not?
And I was like, I love snowboarding, not to do, but to watch. And it's just so amazing, like to see them fly so high. And they're at the very, very edge of their skills, right? Because they're doing stuff they've never done in competition before. They're falling sometimes in sometimes really dramatic ways. And, you know, I don't know, Chloe Kim to me is just this badass who I can't, like, I see her flying up in the air and I have this feeling of what it must be like to be at the very, very edge of your ability, right? And I think the parts of my work that I love the most are when I feel pushed in that way, or I'm pushing myself in that way as a facilitator. And, you know, you create something that you hope is going to happen in the room. You have an agenda, but you actually don't know until you get in there what's going to happen. And people will bring all kinds of stuff, right? They'll show up in all kinds of different ways. They'll ask you questions you never thought of, like some other people I happen to know. And they, I love that. Like, I'm no Chloe Kim, but it's kind of that same feeling for me of like, I'm at the very edge and getting to figure it out as we go is actually my favorite part.
I love that answer. I think that's fascinating that the best part is like almost like the scary parts of it, that you're right there pushing yourself to your limit. And that's what's fun about it.
I mean, I'm secretly kind of a thrill seeker, so.
Yeah, it's like, do you love the adrenaline?
I think it's a really admirable thing, honestly, to say that that's your favorite part of your work. And I think it's really refreshing to see too, in like this nonprofit world that we live in, where not everyone walks their talk, I would say, or absorbs the work that they try to put out into the world. And so talking to you today, it's just been really cool. It's a breath of fresh air. Like, you really are doing the work that you're trying to get others to do too, absorbing it, walking your talk. Yeah, you're just awesome.
Well, I could say the same right back to you too.
So Carrie, how can our listeners who might be interested in attending a Finding Freedom cohort find you and sign up?
We have 3 workshops coming up this spring for beginners, the Finding Freedom workshop. And you can find out about the dates and times and facilitators at wearefindingfreedom.org.
Great. And for all of our listeners, I've been through We Are Finding Freedom and I highly recommend, I think that it is one of the, a great foundational program for you to go through to start thinking about, you know, our future as you move through the world.
And after meeting Carrie, how could you not want to go?
Thank you.
Well, Carrie, I think that honestly brings us to the end of our questions that we had today. But like I said, I had such an amazing time talking to you today. I hope our listeners are feeling motivated right now. I hope they take everything that you told them today and, you know, try to reimagine a new future for themselves with them in it. So yeah, just thank you for being here and thanks for everything you've taught, Taylor and I.
Much gratitude to you both. I'm so happy to be in movement with you. Thanks for helping us create a North Carolina that's built by us.
And thanks for listening to this podcast made of, by, and for the people. Bye.
Bye.
Connect with us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at DemocracyNC. Or you can visit our website at democracync.org.